even has me interested in what I'm going to say here. One thing we're doing real good about moving up on Sunday morning. Sunday mornings, we're doing great. Sunday evening, I still have this, I don't know, I guess you're saving the good seats for the visitors so they can like walk down front. But if you will kind of move forward, and now I say this and they're all going to walk back. I know how this will work, but we'll keep working on that one as well. Turn with me to the book of Proverbs tonight, chapter 26. I really appreciate the book of Proverbs, and it always bothered me that I never heard much preaching on the book. It is just so downright practical and so easy to see what's being said. You can just, every verse is like a picture, and you can picture what's going on here. In Proverbs chapter 26, we're just going to read the four verses that deal with the sluggard tonight. And every last one of them brings a picture to your mind. Unfortunately, sometimes there's a face to the person in the picture, you know. There's always one person you can say, I think I knew him. But let's try to put it in the context of how the Lord might work in our lives tonight. Let's begin in verse 13. The slothful man says, there's a lion in the way. A lion is in the streets. As the door turns upon its hinges, so doth the slothful man upon his bed. The slothful man hideth his hand in his bosom, is what the King James says. All the more modern translation, his dish, his bowl, where he's eating. He hides his hand in his dish, and it grieves him to bring it again to his mouth. A sluggard is wiser in his conceit than his own conceit than seven men can render a reason. One of the things that is easy to see from this passage is that the Proverbs weren't just written here and here and here and here and thrown into the book without a collected order. Many men did write Proverbs, but when they were collected, they were usually put together in books, in chapters. Each chapter was put together by a different group of collectors, each set of chapters, I should say. But the verses are set side by side because they're meant for you to read them and to get a picture of the character of certain people. Just turn back with me to the beginning of this chapter. The first few verses deal with the whole concept of a fool. And let me read these to you. And the concept of you can't win with a fool. Let me read these verses and show you, because then he is going to go on and explain the different kinds of a fool. The word fool, of course, is a theme throughout the book of Proverbs. The foolish man and the wise man. So he starts chapter 26. I think chapter 26 starts a new section of the book. And he deals generally with the topic, you just aren't going to win with a fool. And then he'll begin to describe the different kinds of fools and why their folly is part and parcel of their whole existence. You're not going to change them apart from the grace of God. So let me read these few verses as a background. As snow in summer, and as rain in the harvest season, so honor isn't seemly for a fool. Getting snow in summer, it just doesn't fit. It doesn't look right. And honor never fits a fool. As the bird by wandering and the swallow by flying, so the curse causeless shall not come. He says, listen, he says, the bird has a place to go. You look up and you can't tell where it's coming from and where it's going, but birds don't fly for no reason. They're hunting food, they got a purpose. Well, when somebody gets punishment, when something happens to a person in their life that's the result of their folly, maybe you can't see what brought it, and maybe you can't see the purpose, but it came for a reason. Those things that are happening in their life, and bad things included, are there for a reason. A whip for the horse, a bridle for the ass, and a rod for the fool's back. You can tell he was getting a little frustrated here. And notice these two verses. Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest thou also be like unto him. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own conceit. The message is, of course, you're not going to win with a fool. And then verse 6. He that sendeth a message by the hand of a fool cutteth off the feet and drinks damage. You might as well never have sent them to do it. Have you ever asked one of your children to go say something to someone of the other children? Go tell them that I want to see them. And they run down there. You better go up and see Dad right now. You're in a whole lot of trouble. And he doesn't. And they come up all this. It's like, what do you want? You want to get me a drink of water or something? You know, and they're like, oh, what is it? Well, you never send a message by someone who doesn't have their act together. And then verse 7. The legs of the lame are not even, so is a parable in the mouth of fools. I don't know if you, what the point is that you can give wisdom to a fool, but when he uses it, it comes out all skewed. He can take the wisest saying in the world and apply it in the most foolish and ridiculous circumstance. Wisdom doesn't do a fool any good. And then he begins to talk about different kinds of fools. He begins to talk about a fool that's caught up in his habits, whether that be drinking, whether it be vices. He talks about that kind of fool. Then the sluggard. After that, he talks about a meddler, a gossip, the kind of person who gets involved in everything and makes a mess of it. He begins in verse 24 and talks about the person who has malicious and hurtful things to say with his lips, the kind of person who plans evil for other people, and so on and so forth. Well, when we come to our passage, the point is that there's a whole class of people called fools, and you don't win with them. They're not a person that can be educated. They're not a person that can be trained. We have this idea, and going to Cornell, I know they have it at Cornell, a little bit of education will solve all of our problems. Bring them in for a class, and we'll solve it. Let's bring them in, and let's take care of the problem. What we need in our society is more education. If we educated the kids better and gave them more of an opportunity in school, they wouldn't go out there and commit crime. I don't know. We had to turn down two attorney generals because they had committed crimes, you know, making a whole lot of money. They were both lawyers, which may explain part of it. But, you know, we had to turn two of them down for crimes that they had committed. The idea that giving a person more education and more possibilities is going to change their character, that doesn't work. And we have this idea that you can take people and the problems and you can solve them by something from the outside. Well, the book of Proverbs says foolishness goes right to the bone. And you're not going to be able to beat it out of them. You're not going to be able to change them. All that you can do is see that that foolish character has to be changed. The Bible isn't after changing habits. It's after changing character. I think we work sometimes from the outside in Christianity. We try to get people to change the way they live, and we get people to come to church and do all the things that are good habits, but the Bible works from the inside out. People change the way they live because they've changed as a person. People come to church because they want to be there, because they see that there's something there inside of them that they want. Well, let's look at how the sluggard, it's part and parcel of his life. Just four things here as we work through. Notice, the slothful man says there's a lion in the street, a lion in the way, a lion in the streets. And then flip over to chapter 22. These proverbs in many cases were repeated from other places. Look at verse 13. The slothful man says there is a lion outside. Without doesn't mean that the lion lacks something, you know. There's a lion outside, I shall be slain in the streets. Point number one, he's always got an excuse. He's not lazy, he's just got an excuse. So often when you're trying to get something done and you can't get somebody moving, you go to them and it's so plain to you that they've got to get it done. But there's always a reason. Again, I keep coming back to children because parents are in such a role of educating their children. But did you ever find your kids without an excuse for the reason why something didn't get done? Was there ever a time that, no matter how, by the way, fanciful that excuse was? One of our children was talking last night about another one of their brothers, and they said, you know, he had the greatest excuses, you know. And it seemed to him that mom bought all of them, you know. Dad was a little more skeptical about these matters. But, you know, he could come up with excuses that you'd think, do you honestly expect me to believe that? You know, I'm insulted that you would give me that line. But sometimes the fool, he believes his own excuse. He believes it. this man, it's interesting, one of the commentators I was reading, it's interesting to read commentators from different periods because they express things in different ways, they see different things in the verse, and one of them says, the man's afraid all right, but he's not afraid of the lion, he's afraid of the street. It's getting out there and getting involved. If he goes out in the street, he might have to do something, he might have to go someplace. That's what he's afraid of. You know, so often in our life, when we're not getting something done, we've got to look and say, maybe it's because of some sloth in our life. We've got a reason why that doesn't get done. We've got a reason why this doesn't get done. I got to tread carefully here because maybe you're the only husband that doesn't have a long honey-do list, you know, that never seems to get done. So I'm going to try to avoid that one. You know, I wouldn't want to be a hypocrite or anything, but you know, there's always a reason why it doesn't get done. But when something has to be done and you don't do it, when something's right straight in front of you, we always manage to come up with an excuse. Spiritually is the same thing. There's always an excuse why that person wasn't where they were supposed to be. There's a reason why your devotional life. Well, Lord, my devotional life would be so much better if only I didn't have kids. Yeah, maybe you'd have some more time, but I doubt it. How great was your devotional life before you had kids? How great is your devotional life when your kids move out of home? You know, there's always an excuse. There's always a reason why a person can't come to church, why a person can't pray. Always a reason why you can't tell somebody about the Lord. And what it is an excuse. It's not a reason. And we have to look and say one of the reasons why a fool, a sluggard, never changes is because he's got a reason for everything he does. He seems to be justified. And that's our way of life. Instead of looking for what we should be doing and doing it, we fear. There's something we don't want to do, and so we come up with another fear. I've seen that so often, by the way, in church. I haven't been here long enough to see it here, but I've seen it, having pastored for 15, 20 years, you see it, that when somebody has something that they don't want to face, that they don't want to do, they've always got an excuse in the completely opposite direction. Sometimes people cannot face the fact that they're wrong or that something's going on, so they come up with an excuse in the opposite direction. Sometimes the preaching gets a little too pointed. The preaching just hits home, so they're not being fed anymore. It's interesting. You know, the preaching is getting too pointed and God's hitting them too often, and so we need a little bit more teaching. A ministry. Why? Because the teaching ministry isn't supposed to point out your sin. You know, teaching's supposed to be nice and general and I learn something rather than the other side of it, which is change this, change this, change this. So often there are so many people who are, they're afraid to witness. They're simply afraid to evangelize. It's intimidating to them. They don't want to make the effort. And that to me is the number one reason why evangelism doesn't get done. But you know what they do? They gain a theological objection to it. Well, I don't want to be like that church down there. They're all evangelism and they're all froth. And as Doc Pickering used to say, they're all foam and no beer. You know, I don't want to be like that church. You know, I want a little hops in my life. You know, I've seen people like that and they get out there and it's all very shallow and no teaching. Okay, maybe that is true. I wouldn't think so, but maybe that is true. But in most cases, people use that. They throw that up as an excuse why their church isn't evangelizing, why they're not telling people. I can't knock on doors. Don't. When you sit down with somebody at work, tell them what happened in your life. I just don't meet people well. You meet people every day. You talk to people every day. You know, it's one thing, and I can see where it is intimidating to go to somebody's house, and visiting is intimidating. But evangelism shouldn't be. And so what we do is we come up with an excuse why we don't do that. And so often we throw these things out. And whether we don't like it or not, it's sloth. We're too lazy. We just don't want to put the effort into what it takes because anything to get done takes effort. And sometimes Satan can work in our hearts, and it's not always Satan from the outside, it's our own sinfulness from within, to get us to do something we shouldn't. But I think more victories are won by the sin side of us, by keeping us from doing what we should. It's always easier to keep somebody from doing something than to make them do something. It's always easier to put just a few obstacles in the path. This guy sees obstacles where there aren't any, because he's afraid of that. And he doesn't want to face the fact that he's afraid of that. So he points to something else. Notice the next verse. As the door turns upon the hinges, so the slothful man upon his bed. Oh, I love that one. Just turning over and over and over and over. Again, as a parent, the natural is, has it ever bothered you that you had to get up early on a morning to get out and do something and to run an errand, and you come home and, 10:15, you've been out on a full day's work, and you come in and you notice that there's somebody missing around the house. That's one of your kids, and you're still sleeping. Now, the fact that I used to sleep until the late hours of the morning, when I was their age, that I've forgotten all that. You know, I don't want to hear that anymore. I used to do it, but I don't want to hear that anymore. What bothers you is the fact that they're there and you want to attribute it to sloth, you know, or to the fact that they're up till 4 a.m. watching TV or whatever it is. This isn't talking about that. This isn't talking about the period that kids go through in their life when, you know, that happens. This is talking about a guy who just loves himself. He just loves to coddle himself. And he can't make himself get up and do anything. There are some habits. I had a teacher at school who pointed out some habits. He says, you ever notice that there are some people, you can tell if they're lazy just by the way they sit. He says, when they go to sit down, they only make it to within 6 inches of the seat, and then they drop. And they get down, and the first 6 inches are the 6 inches they can't make. It's like, they can't. It's the first and the last 6 inches that do them in. Well, you know, that's pretty much the truth of so many people. They get comfortable. They have something they like, and they don't want to stir from it to do what they should do. And that's a real indictment, I know, on our spiritual lives. We like what we're comfortable with. We don't want to stir ourselves to do something different. Our bedroom in the parsonage is warm as toast, and my wife loves it. On the other hand, I grew up where we had no heat in the upstairs. We had no heat in the house, but one little stove, you know. And boy, in the morning, you know, that bed was nice and warm, basically because there were three of us in it, you know. And that bed was nice and warm. And you woke up, and you didn't just pop out of bed. You know, you kind of looked around, and you took a look here, and you took a look there, and it was like, okay. Yeah! And you jumped out of bed, you pulled on some clothes, and you ran for the stove, and you put your backside right up against the stove, and you'd get up in the morning and you'd see our whole family, you know, better side to the stove, you know, and the whole family just standing around getting warmed up. There's something about a cold day that does that, but this is somebody, it's not the bed and it's not the cold, they just don't want to be moved. They don't want to, from this side to this side. They'll move all right, but only just enough to get comfortable again. It's not a question of moving, because a lot of these lazy people, they move a lot in bed. Flop, 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 flop. Usually in a marriage, there's a flopper and there's a quiet one, you know, and they drive each other nuts, you know. I don't know why it is. God seems to bring together one person who likes the bedroom warm, one who likes it cold, one who flops, one who keeps still, one who steals covers, one who gets stolen from. You know, that's life. But the flopper here is the lazy man. It's like in a hinge. Go back and forth. And it's interesting, he's not tied to the bed, he's hinged to it, you know? And he will never come unhinged. He's back and he's forth. There's a lot of motion, but nothing getting done. Not going any place. That is one of the saddest things to see in the Christian life. When you see somebody who won't move, they won't go where they are, they won't step out. I think that that's sometimes a challenge to our young people, to say, hey, listen, there's a world out there, and God expects you to do something in it. He expects you to do something for him, and you're going to have to come unhinged to do that. You know, a home is pretty comfortable. I started recognizing that at a young age. It's like, you know, somebody's paying for this food, and somebody's paying for these clothes. And then I started to think about it, and I said, you know, that might be me. And I wondered about that. And, you know, God had to move in my life to get you to leave that kind of comfort. And you get out there and you find out all the things that everybody else found out. It's not so easy to get a job, and it's not so easy to pay the bills. Where we ministered previously in Laurel, it was fascinating that the parents, all the kids would have a job. There are very few children in the church who, young people still at home, who didn't have a job. And the parents said, well, that's really good for them because it's building responsibility. And it was doing exactly the opposite, because the kids would bring those paychecks home and they'd spend them. Well, they're buying their own clothes, they're buying this, they're buying that, and they're learning responsibility and spending money. Oh, no, they're not, because those kids have more spending money than their parents do. You know, maybe they're bringing home, after working a full week, they're bringing home $50 or $60 to spend on different things. Unless you're doing a whole lot better than I am, I don't have $50 or $60 to go out and spend on what I want every week. And so the kids were learning, and they got comfortable at home, and they found out I can get everything provided, and I can have a stipend, and they didn't want to leave home. It was a fascinating thing. They didn't want to get out there. I wouldn't. You know, I'll move in with their folks, you know. You know, you let me live with you, and then I got lots of spending money. Well, what happens is there comes a point in people's lives where they've got to learn, you got to move. You know, you can't just be flopping around. It's the same thing spiritually. God sets something in front of you that's uncomfortable. Just like getting out of the bed, you're leaving something comfortable for something that isn't. He puts something in front of you that's uncomfortable. And if you're not willing to leave, the fancy word they use today is your comfort zone, if you're not willing to leave that, you'll never do anything for God. In the church, maybe you've reached a place where your ministries are the ones that are comfortable for you. If you want to grow, you better at least be willing to move into ministries that are uncomfortable for you. You don't grow by doing the thing that's comfortable and comfortable and comfortable. That's not how you grow. God has designed it so that you have to try something different in order to grow. And so often Christians come to the place where they don't want to admit it, but they just don't want to leave their bed. The motion's there, they're still doing it, but they're not going anyplace. And it's because they're hinged to whatever they're comfortable with. And you need to look at your life, and maybe it's what you're doing in your ministry. Maybe you've become complacent with your relationship to the church and you're not moving forward and doing more and working in there. Maybe it's your devotions. But God says that sloth, that simple unwillingness, it's self-love. You're comfortable and that's your first priority. Look at the next verse too. The slothful man hides his hand in his bosom and it grieves him to bring it again to his mouth. Again, I do not like to give the impression as a pastor that you are criticizing a version of the Bible, as if you know more than all the men who translated it. One of the problems with the King James in the Old Testament was it was written 350 years ago, and we've learned a whole lot about the Hebrew language in 350 years. When you read the Proverbs, there are some very hard to work with because it's not like a paragraph where you got a lot of context and you can tell what's going on. The other side is, as I'll mention with this verse, it's tied into the culture of the day. It's tied into how people lived when this proverb was written. And because of archaeology, there was no archaeology when the King James Bible was written. None. Archaeology was unheard of. If somebody stumbled across something, a statue or something, but nobody would ever systematically try to figure out the culture that the people lived in. So the translators were kind of shackled. Now translators have a wealth of information. We know how people lived, we know what their houses were like, and these proverbs were written to people who lived in the culture, and they would understand it. People in the Middle East, especially the shepherds and the Bedouins, the way they ate was very much similar to the way Christ ate at the Last Supper. And Bedouins do the same thing today. Everybody eats out of one pot. Not for me. I'm not telling you this is the best way to live, but everybody eats out of one pot and you make a stew, some kind of boiled. Sometimes it's meat, because shepherds always have meat available, and you stew something. And you boil it in, you throw everything in the pot, and then you have, you know, everybody know what pita bread is? Okay, well, the advantage of pita bread is the flat bread that raises is when you break it apart, you've got a little scoop, a built-in scoop. And you reach in to whether the rice or the whatever is in the center and the meat, and you scoop it out. You dip it. The New Testament word is you baptize your bread. You stick your bread into it and you immerse it. It's kind of like, think of it like Hebrew nachos. Okay, it's just like nachos for Jews. You know, they're just dipping it in there and they're dipping out the nacho. Well, that's what it means. It says he hideth his hand. The area, though, that would bother us is they didn't, you know, the thing about nacho crackers is they make them so that for Westerners where you can hold one hand of the cracker and it's only the nacho chip that goes in the nacho. Well, for them, they put their whole hand in there. So everybody's hand is going in, is dipping down in. Yeah, I know. I was like, they still eat that way, by the way. They only use their right hand, and there are reasons for that that I won't get into. But when everybody sits around, they lean down, and they're dipping with their bread into the pot. And they're putting it here. And here's the picture of the fool. He hides his hand in the dish. He puts his hand down in there to get the food. But it pains him to bring it to his mouth again. You know, he can't bring himself. He's got the food in his hand, and it's just such a weariness to bring it to his mouth. He can't finish it. Well, there's a reason for that. When the way that they were eating and they in those days is they would lay on their side for the most part. Or sometimes they would sit cross-legged, but the Bedouins, for the most part, would lean on their side. And you're leaning on one arm, and you reach over with the other arm, and you dip in. And so it's an effort to reach out and get the food. That much to do is an effort. Let me go into one other thing here. That is why, when it says John laid his head on Jesus' bosom. You know, today, sometimes they picture him as kind of a big sissy, you know. You know, putting his head on Jesus' bosom. Well, when the men were laying around the table, they were laying around the table in such a way that, one, your feet don't get near the table. That was why you washed feet and whatnot. But two, you laid sideways, okay, to each other, because you rapidly find out that laying around the table this way, nobody can look at one another if you're all facing the same way. And so when you've got one person on the corner laying like this and one person laying like this, when you want to talk to somebody, you lean your head over and you're almost in their chest and you're looking up at them. We wouldn't do that because Westerners like to be miles apart. But I mentioned to you, people in the East get very close to one another when they talk. They talk face to face. That's what they mean by face to face. So when it says John was laying on Jesus' bosom, it's because the way they laid around the table, I believe, and the way the Last Supper was observed. But if you're laying on your right side and you can only eat with your right hand, every time that you want to get something to eat, you have to lift up and reach over and get something to eat and come down again. So my point is getting your hand into the dish is what required the effort. And the fool, what's being said here is, if he puts out the effort to start something, he doesn't have the effort to finish it. He gets exhausted by the effort to start something. And when it's within his very grasp, he can't finish it. The sluggard, if he does get something started, will never get it finished. And again, I'm not going to preach on household chores, you know, on jobs around the house. I'll save that for another day. But what's your reputation? What's your character? Are you known as the kind of person who finishes what you start out to do? Are you known as the kind of person who will see something through to the end? I'm in a school, and it's amazing. When you go for a doctorate, there's a lot involved. I mean, a lot of different steps involved. It's not just classes. The classes are possibly the easiest part of obtaining the doctorate. And what happens is that after you've taken all your classes, you take a first level of exams to make sure you know enough from the classes. Then they give you all kinds of reading in your field, all kinds of books and things to be conversant in, and they say, we want you to know this much about your field. and they'll give you a period of time, and then you come back and you take the really tough exams. They're called A exams, and they might give you 30, 40 books and say know everything in them. And you're going to answer any question. They want to make sure before you get a doctorate that you know your field well, okay? But that's after you take those exams, then you have to go out and write your dissertation. You've got some of these dissertations, you never want to read a doctoral dissertation. They have to find a new area to write about. So they write about things, you know, the liver flukes and all kinds of weird things that nobody cares about. But it's interesting, right now, I was reading a statistic across the United States, doctoral students, the percentage of doctoral students who are at each level. And right now, the percentage of doctoral students who are in the stage of taking classes is 20%. 80% of them have taken all their classes, but they haven't written their dissertation. And in fact, there's a term for that, ABD, all but dissertation. Because that's where you've got to get out and do it on your own. You know, in a class, somebody else is telling you, learn this and learn this and learn this. Somebody else put the books in front of you and said, this is what you need to know for your oral exams. But the dissertation takes a lot of self-discipline. And what's happening is so many people are dropping by the wayside because they never get their dissertation written. They never get out there, they never tackle it, they never get it done. That's what's happening in life in general. It's that people get things started and they don't finish. In fact, most schools now have a 7-year limit. You have to have your dissertation finished by 7 years after the day that you first enroll, because students are just taking forever and never getting it done. As a church, I first of all praise the Lord that I've got a Savior who never started anything that he didn't finish. He started with me a long time ago, and he's still working on me. He doesn't drop the ball. But what's my reputation? What about what I try to do spiritually? How many times do I start to do something for the Lord and I drop it? And I just, that passes by the wayside. Here's another good idea gone. Here's another good idea gone. And that really convicts me that that's not right. That's what the Bible calls sloth. When you start something, you finish it. And so often people are exhausted by the effort to get something going that finishing it is hard. I am not a really big believer in having lots and lots of evangelistic meetings and lots of meetings. And there are different reasons for that. But it's kind of one thing. Have you ever seen the attendance patterns at special meetings? You start out, and if you've done your job in promoting and getting things done, your first night starts out great, and then what happens? Ding, 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 ding. It's like people get worn out by the effort, the tremendous effort of driving to church, you know, showing up, the tremendous effort of sitting and listening, and then, although occasionally we stand to sing, we almost always stand to sing. Did you notice why people were laughing tonight? You said, let's stand and sing sitting at the feet of Jesus. We told them on Wednesday night, when you sing Standing on the Promises, you can't sit down. And now we're wondering, how come you can't sit to sing Sitting at the Feet of Jesus? So it's Baptists. We make you do that. But people get worn out by effort. When they get involved in church, there are so many people that start out well, and they don't finish well. Paul's testimony was, I finished what you gave me to do. It's not important how you start out. Only that the way you start out and the way you finish is good. God wants to see good finishers in what you do. Maybe you made yourself some promises earlier about your devotions, about your prayer life, about witnessing. And maybe you've slacked off on that. Well, it's time to pick it up again. It's time to learn that as the slothful man, he has things right in his grasp, literally. He has the food in his hand, in his grasp, but it's just too weary to bring it back to his mouth again. And the last, the sluggard is wiser in his own conceit than 7 men can render a reason. You see, the problem with the sluggard is he thinks he's smart. He doesn't think he's a fool. He thinks he's the smart one. Look at all those guys out there shoveling their driveway. Don't they know the sun's going to come out sooner or later and do the job for them? Am I the only person who's ever heard somebody say that? Oh, you know, why shovel the driveway? Pretty soon the cars, you know, somebody will drive a car in here sooner or later and we'll be able to get out. That may be amusing unless you're married to somebody like that. By the way, there's nothing funny about living with a person who is characterized by all these things. We're all at some point given to these things, but somebody whose character is a sluggard, that must be a horrible thing to live, because you'll learn to live without a lot of things. And this sluggard, though, thinks he's smart. He has a reason for everything. One of the commentators had a nice little phrase. He said, he won't finish anything and he won't face anything. Seven men can sit down and talk to him, using that round number in the Bible for a full number of men, can sit down and give him a good reason why he should do it. And yet he's got it all figured out in his brain, why this is going to work and why this is going to work and why this is going to work. There's always a reason why not doing it was smarter than doing it. There's always a reason why he thinks he's so wise. Occasionally, I ride a van into work, and occasionally one of the men who rides in on the van seems to give at least this impression. Sometimes when you're riding in with other fellows to work, you talk about all the things you have to do, and I got this done, and problems you face. One of the men was doing plumbing, and that's the nightmare. You can't start a plumbing job because you got to finish it. That's the nightmare, And then one piece goes, the next piece goes, and the next piece, and you want to do 3 feet, and you end up replacing the whole system or something. Every single time, this guy will come up with a reason, you fools. He'll use the word that. You fools, he says, I don't do that kind of stuff anymore. I've learned to do this, or I've learned to do that, everybody's kind of looking at him like, oh, boy. Maybe he is a very industrious man, but he certainly doesn't give the impression. He gives the impression that he thinks he's so smart because he's avoided doing these things. And you talk to people all the time who think they're so smart because they're getting out of work. When you work with people and you find people who have the most ingenious ways to get out of doing their work or to give you their work. And you find that they think they're so smart. You find people who have ways of getting out of their taxes. I don't want to talk to somebody who found a fraudulent way to get out of their taxes. I don't want to talk to you because I paid mine. And I don't think that's smart. Everybody seems to think they have a new ingenious way and they think they're so smart. That's what it means. They're wise in their own conceit. Their conceit is a foolishness that appears to them to be smart, because it allows them to do what they always wanted to do. And if a person gets to do what he wants to do, he thinks he was pretty smart. When you look at the book of Proverbs, it says, wisdom is there for those who love the Lord and who want to pick it up. You can lay as much wisdom as you want, as we started out this. You can lay as much wisdom as you want on a fool, and it won't do him any good. Because you're not only telling him something he can't understand, you're telling him something he doesn't want to hear. He doesn't want to hear how he could get out and do more work. He doesn't want to hear why his excuses don't pay. He doesn't want to hear any of those things. All he wants to hear is that it's okay. I, in some cases, think that a pastor could make a profession of that, preaching and telling people what they want to hear. They want to hear these things. They want to hear it's okay to be the same. They want to hear it's okay to have their fears. It's okay to hold on to some of these things. And as long as a pastor will pull everybody together and say, it's okay, and come up with a wise reason to do it, people feel good. And yet that's not the ministry. Each of us has to say, no, that's being slothful. I just don't want to face what's in front of me. And instead I come up with these excuses. Like I said, sometimes you can see you can just see somebody's face, a person doing some of these things. But what most grieves me is that I can see my own face here too. I really can. I can see things I've done this week that fit into this pattern. And my lesson is Christ saved me not to act like a fool, but to act like a wise man, and to listen to these things and to come home and say, what am I going to change this week? And that's what I'd ask you to do. Look at these things and come home and say, what am I going to do this week about it? Let's pray. Oh, Father, your word has been so true and so right, and I praise you for it. I pray, Father, that rather than even tonight for me to give thought to what other people could or should or might do, let me think about what I ought to do. And Father, let me do the work you've put before me. Let me be a servant that doesn't bring dishonor, and Father, that just that my life might not be filled with the pain of my foolishness, but it might be filled with the blessing that comes from knowing you and doing what's right. Help us each to do what you've put before us tonight. And may we as a church be characterized by people who carry out the will of your Son and do it promptly. It's in Jesus' name we pray.